Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is David Shields, the author, most recently, of Remote, published by Alfred Knopf. He's the author of a book of short stories, A Handbook for Drowning, a novel, Dead Languages, and an earlier novel, Heroes. Recently, at lunch, a waiter, seeing me read Remote, came up to me and told me that he had loved Dead Languages. And I asked him, well, you know, what did you love about it? And he said, well, it's about a boy who stutters and his relationship to a mother who is in control of language. She's a writer. And that relationship had impressed itself on him over 6 years. I get the feeling that David Shields is a writer that people are slowly discovering. At any rate, the news about him spreads more slowly than other news does. And I thought that this has become, in a sense, the subject of Remote. The condition of being a writer, which is to say, to be in the culture that includes the possibility of fame and not yet to be famous. So it's a book of resentment, condescension, cultural analysis, hijinks on the subject of what becomes famous. How did you come to write it?
Well, I think you've almost described how I've come to write it, in the sense that I think you're exactly right, Michael, that it, in a way the book is sort of born in a way of envy or resentment or anger or schadenfreude of some kind. So in a way, the book sort of was born by feeling marginalized as a writer. I mean, the feeling, first of all, sort of marginalized from the society, which is beholden to images, but then also even marginalized to a certain degree by the world of literature, in which I have a certain sort of reputation, but I'm not a famous writer. And how it came to be written is a complicated story. Basically, I was reading an interview with Milan Kundera, in which he talked about, the interviewer was asking him how he came to write so well about the mixture of personal life and political life. He basically said it's not hard if you go to a grocery store and a Soviet tank is sticking out of the back of the grocery store. And I asked myself, inevitably, what is the American equivalent of the Soviet tank? That we're not an occupied country and we're not exactly a religious state. So what is the equivalent of the American Soviet tank? And at the time I was reading the interview, I actually was lying on my father's couch in an apartment in San Francisco and watching the public broadcasting station, Channel 9, KQED up there. And there was a juggler on TV who was riding a unicycle. And he pretended to be having trouble juggling these knives. And he pretended to be having trouble riding a unicycle. But really, he was in exquisite artistic control of both the unicycle and the knives. And I loved how he pretended to be in danger but really wasn't, and was in complete control. And I was particularly sort of moved by the fact that I was watching him on television. And I actually started crying. I was sort of moved to tears, literally, by this juggler on TV. And to me, that was the answer to Kundera's Soviet tank, in the sense that I feel the American equivalent of the Soviet tank is the ubiquity of the camera, the immense power of the camera lens on our life, on my life, on the way I think about life. At that point, I resolved to write a book about it.
I'm curious, you know, although I believe what you're saying, at the same time, what I notice in the two previous books, Dead Languages and A Handbook for Drowning, is an immense level of tenderness and vulnerability, that the story of the stuttering boy and the stories about the parents in A Handbook for Drowning are ones that expose the writer to the potential for humiliation. If there is a writer who would not thrive in front of a camera, one would assume it would be the writer of Dead Languages and A Handbook for Drowning. And then Remote comes, and its tone seems knowing in a way that the other books try to avoid. I can't explain it except that when I was reading A Handbook for Drowning, I found myself thinking that you were the kind of writer who writes very plain sentences, and that the sentences, you know, the way flypaper attracts flies, the sentences attract feelings, so that the reader is moved not by the sentences, but by the feelings the sentences compel, a certain amount of earnestness, a certain amount of over-painful exposure. And that suddenly here in Remote, it's almost as if there's, well, that hasn't worked for me so far. I want to see what a certain amount of cynical reading of the culture can do for me. Is that at all true?
It's interesting. I've seen a couple of reviews that talk about the book a little bit like that. But I have a number of responses to what you say. And to me, it's an interesting observation that the tone somehow is a little bit different, more kind of acid and more, I don't know what it is. To me, I see the whole corpus of my work, all four books, from Heroes to Dead Languages to Handbook to Remote, being sort of one arc, each book becoming less linear, more fragmented, more pointillistic, more confessional, and more directly about the culture. So to me, it's all one movement, which wasn't consciously planned. I also think of Remote as being actually an extremely emotional book. I mean, it's phrased with a kind of acid irony and a kind of cynical riffing tone. But to me, is actually quite an emotional book about the way it builds toward a confession about my own tendency and predilection for remoteness as an emotional state toward which I'm drawn.
Yes, I know, and yet it's funny because A, the previous books don't seem remote in that way, and B, whereas before, it seems to me, the hero is of interest because he is an outcast. Now, in American culture, the one way to lose an audience is to say that someone is a loner or an outcast or a misfit. This was, you know, the essence of what the hero of a 60s novel had to be. And now, you see, in Remote, the hero is presenting himself as being somewhat emotionally repellent. He presents himself as being someone who calls, you know, fat people fatzos or fatties and is obsessively concerned about what he eats while he eats too many desserts. There's an interest in presenting what was previously the outcast character as the kind of snarling ringleader of a finger-pointing culture.
I don't see that at all.
Okay.
I really don't. I see him, or me, the narrator, David Shields, who's a kind of exaggerated version of myself, as being now, frankly, the outcast of immediate culture into which I'm trying to bang the door into, so that I'm always having these near-miss brushes with semi-famous people, whether they're Joseph Schildkraut, who may or may not be a relative of mine, or David Milch, a former creative writing teacher who became a television producer, or a weird identification I have with sort of martyr alter egos like Bob Balaban or Stuttering John Melendez. So to me, I mean, your reading of the book would be fine with me. I don't have any great problem with it. I just simply disagree in the sense that, to me, in dead languages, say, Jeremy Zorn is outcast from the world of fluent language in exactly the way your waiter friend talked about it. And now we've just sort of moved environments, and now it's this character, this persona called David Shields, who seems to want a refuge from the maelstrom of his emotional life and find a kind of glib, glorified fluency in the iconography of mass culture. He keeps on banging on the door and not quite getting let in. He's seduced by all of these religious totems, knows they're counterfeit, but still sort of wants them as solace from loneliness, mortality, fallibility, imperfection. So to me, we're still in the same place.
Except, I guess, now bear in mind, you're talking to someone who confesses, self-confessedly, is a bookworm. And so here's someone who, on some level, ironic or not, finds himself shut out from the world of Oprah. And I think to myself as a
so
reader,
what?
Yeah, who would want to be there? And
I
what
see.
Serious writer, certainly,
I see.
Would want to, you know, storm that particular bastion and have the public know whether or not you've gained weight or not? You know,
who cares?
Who cares? Who would,
I see,
who would
I see
want
your point.
It?
Oh, I see.
And why, in a sense, write for? You know, one has the horrible feeling that maybe the American world no longer contains people to write for. And that is often a world presented by newspapers.
Right.
That there no longer is literacy, there are no more readers, there's this, there's that. But it seems to me, in fact, that the true case is that they don't know where to find them. They mm-hmm. go to universities and they find theorists.
Mm-hmm.
They go, you know, who knows where. But readers live wherever they live. They don't all have the same condo or apartment complex. They don't vote the same way. So they're not a constituency anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And in the world of, you know, representative constituencies, readers, you know, are ignored.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they've disappeared. And I guess anyone who, you know, you come, one gathers from over all of the books, from a family with a father and mother who both wrote, whose ideas about the value of the word or something was extremely idealistic. And, you know, this book, it seems to me to be about the fall from that idealism, a world in which the word doesn't offer you entree to significant action and admirability anymore.
Hmm. I think that seems an interesting sort of road to the book. That I would agree with a lot of that. I guess that for me it's crucial to think of the book as one that is I wanted to write a book. I mean, I felt like I'm an autobiographical writer, and after Dead Languages, a Handbook for Drowning, I had to figure out sort of what I was going to do next. I couldn't sort of endlessly chronicle my childhood. I felt like I'd done that. I was terribly interested in that as a repository of imagination. And the one sort of novel of mine that was made up whole cloth, Heroes, is by far my least interesting book, in my opinion. So I was at a crucial crossroads at the end of Handbook for Drowning of where to go next, to reinvent myself as a quote-unquote sort of real novel as sort of making up characters and plots, or go deeper into autobiography but not try and drown in self-absorption. And I felt like I was actually influenced quite heavily by that somewhat notorious essay that Tom Wolfe published in Harper's around 88 called Stalking the Billion-Footed Beast, Urging American Writers. Do you recall that piece? And, Wolfe got a lot of things wrong, an awful lot of things wrong, but there was part of it that really rang true to me, which was the idea that American writers should not yield the stuff of American culture to other media like TV and film. And I wanted to write a book about what felt like American culture. So I think this is a long way of saying that to me, I'm still a bookworm. I read voraciously. I hardly ever watch TV, actually. I haven't been to a movie theater since my daughter was born 3 years ago. I mean, it's a persona I've created. I mean, I like the movies. I watch some TV, I read stupid magazines sometimes. But to me, it's kind of a nonfiction novel almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've created a persona called David Shields, who's a media junkie, who's addicted to all this stuff, this junk. And, there's enough of me in it that I could write the book. I am probably more drawn to media drivel than other writers, perhaps, but by no means to the. I mean, I could care less. Oprah Winfrey. I went there just to get a chapter out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't particularly interested in Oprah Winfrey. So I think it's crucial to see my character, David Shields, as a persona. I hope I've created, who's a kind of representative of American obsession with beauty, celebrity, transmitted kinds of images as a way to suggest something of the anatomy of American culture.
I think that what happens for me in this book is that I picked it up and said, this book, it's a kind of country cousin of You and I, that Nicholson Baker book, in which he inflates himself out of, a couple of small meetings with John Updike into his rival and alter ego and severest critic, then the tendency toward memoir. This will seem like the most unfair thing in the world, and I don't mean it that way. What I love about the previous two books is that they don't seem to me to be calculated. They don't situate themselves in the midst of a circus of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may, in fact, be the case that a novelist now, if he wants any kind of attention, has got to not only write a novel but find a way to situate it so that different canons are aimed at it. But it sort of breaks my heart because these books at least read to me as if the author has been trying to get simpler and simpler and simpler to arrive at some kind of universal feeling about family, about relations and relatives that most novelists have become almost too sophisticated to try and deal with. These are not in any sense, or only in the vaguest sense, meta-novels or self-reflexive novels, although they contain self-consciousness, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Remote, while elements of the character stay the same, it's as if this is the book of calculations. The Book of Swords.
Of Swords? In what sense?
Suddenly I thought of the tarot deck.
Oh.
Here the author is, in a sense, laying out, there are 52 chapters, 52 cards, a deck of solitaire in which he's imagining various versions of potential success for himself, none of which he respects, but all of which he wants to court.
Or pretend to court.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, again, I disagree. I mean, I'm interested in your take, which seems an intelligent one, but it's simply not true in the sense that the reviews of the book have generally been good, but a few people have seen this book as really quite calculated. And really, I wasted 5 years of my life trying to figure out how to write the book. I mean, I knew the material I wanted to deal with, and people sort of were wondering, well, gee, why are there photographs and footnotes, and, you know, in what way is it trying to be related to Douglas Coupland or Mark Lehner or Nicholson Baker or this or that? I mean, I thought that this book was going to be published by an academic press and be published, and there would be three reviews. It was the book I needed to write. That may sound hopelessly disingenuous, but it's not. I had come to a dead end with writing the relatively traditional fiction I'd been writing. There really is, to me, this interesting arc from heroes toward remote, again, less linear, more fragmented, more confessional. I mean, part of it is the influence of writers and other artists I've been influenced by. First, I'm very influenced by certain writers like George W. S. Trow and Renata Adler, actually, in Speedboat, Trow, and Within the Context of No Context. People who use an autobiographical mode to create something that's anthropological and a kind of anatomy of the culture. Also, I'm very influenced by self-reflexive documentary filmmakers like Ross McElwee of Sherman's March. Do you know that film? Mm-hmm. And also certain performance artists and comedians like Sandra Bernard, Spalding Gray, Rick Reynolds, Dennis Leary, and people like that. People who have figured out a way to use themselves, use their life stories as a way to both tell something that's intimately confessional. At the same time, it seems to be speaking in an interesting way, to my mind, to the culture. I was tired of being so tiny. I mean, not necessarily in terms of well-known or being sort of recognizable or quote-unquote sort of famous, but rather my material started to seem too postage stamped to me. I was sort of working on too small a canvas to my satisfaction. And frankly, I'd exhausted the material. I mean, I'd done it. I'd written two books on childhood. I was sort of starting a family of my own. I wasn't prepared to write about them yet. And I mean, it's a book. I mean, my editor, a woman I work with at Knopf named Ann Close, who has been the editor of the last three books, had a really interesting take on the book. And she said, Dead Languages was about your ambivalence about communication, how you both love and hate the written word. And Remote is almost the epitaph of that, or something like that. That there's a sense in which Remote is it's continuing the discussion. I mean, all of my books are about the difficult beauty of human communication. I mean, that's the core of all of my work, from Heroes to Remote. And Remote, unfortunately, is simply the most recent and most pessimistic view of the chances for human beings to communicate. A lot of the book is about the ecstasy of the vicarious state. I mean, a lot of the book is an ode to vicariousness, whether it's in all kinds of ways, whether through a letter that is written but never returned, or through various kinds of channel surfing, or through this whole chapter on women wearing glasses and my apparent erotic attraction to that. And there's a whole number of ways in which the book is both an ode to and a meditation on vicarious kinds of communication.
What it feels like is that Remote enters, more than any of the other books, the realms of irony, which is, you know, said to be, you know, the Valley of Death, the place from which no traveler returns. I wondered, do you anticipate, is there any cure for irony?
I suppose that there's a cure, but I'm not especially looking for one. Part of the way that I look at life is certainly through a very ironic lens, and certainly irony runs through all of my work. I guess in Remote, the irony is much more directly manifest, probably because the material demands it, that I'm dealing with the seductions and the idiocies and glamours and transgressions of a sort of media culture. And given that, a strongly ironic stance seemed crucial. But I think that irony and very real emotion can exist simultaneously. And I think the cure for irony is letting it coexist with genuine emotion without having to feel that the irony has to be actually deleted.
You said to me that irony is a shield, and given that your name is David Shields, it seems a very loaded statement. Irony is a shield against what?
Irony is a shield against, I would say, sort of anguish or pain or vulnerability, I would think. And to me, all good irony, I mean, all good comedy has as its base tremendous amount of pain and anguish. And to me, again, I think of Remote as being quite an anguished sort of cri de coeur about a weird entrapment in the psychological state of remoteness, both in myself and the culture. And the only way I can phrase it is as a rather deadpan irony. But I think the way I read the book, and I hope the way that readers read the book, is the irony is the thinnest of masks for a rather searing cry from the heart of wanting refuge from that, but not being able to figure out a way out yet.
I've been speaking to David Shields, the author most recently of Remote, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Too. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book, off the mouse, pop, die.